Join Jeff, Steve, and Ray on the inaugural reel of 2012 as the boys take a jump back to 1942 and watch Casablanca, exploring all the ways that this movie has influenced popular culture. Is it worth the hype and stand the test of time? From one world war to the next, the boys jump over the Mediterranean and back into the trenches of World War I to discuss Spielberg's take on the 1982 children's novel, War Horse. Is this trip into no man's land worth the price of admission? Finally, from the distant past, we warp into the future to look at the new trailer for Ridley Scott's upcoming Prometheus, the long-anticipated return to a genre he helped define in the late 70s and early 80s. Is it enough to get our butts into the seat? All this and news about Akira's development nightmare, zombie trilogies, and the return of the debate to post-convert or not in this 86th reel of COL Movies, Be Brave, Fear God, Honor the King.
The past.
You tell me you built a time machine? Out of a DeLorean?
The present.
When does this happen in the movie?
Now. You're looking at now, sir. Everything that happens now is happening now.
The future.
Hi. Welcome to the future.
And I'm telling you, it's great here.
You're listening to COL Movies.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to a brand spanking new edition of COL Movies. This is reel number 86. My name is Jeff, and I would like to introduce my exhilarating co-hosts, Ray and Steve. How are you guys doing?
Oh, I needed that. Sorry.
Wow, that had vibrated and stuff.
That was exhilarating.
Nice. I feel better.
Okay. Do we have any more news to put in here, or can we actually go into it?
No, we can go in it.
Okay, I just saw one being added just as we started recording, so I'm just checking. On to the
news. On the mark.
Live action Akira put on hold. Is this kind of really you didn't think it wouldn't be put on hold?
I think it's funny. The reason it's been put on hold, which is they don't want to spend $90 million on it. They have to find some way to cut $20 million, I think, from the budget.
This is going to sound terrible, but maybe they should use Asian actors.
Oh.
See, I told you that was horrible. I'm sorry. Yeah. But wow. I think the main thing I was saying is a lot of the people that they were trying to cast in a couple of these parts were high-priced white celebrities.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why. I mean, maybe they can get high-priced Asian actors too, but still, in some sense, I'm happy that this is put on hold, and wouldn't be surprised if it eventually just gets canceled.
Well, did you see? Did you see the other names of actors that are seem to be up for parts? Helena Carter. Yeah, Kristen Stewart.
Yeah. See, exactly. I like Helena Bonham Carter. It's like thump.
Maybe Tim Burton's just waiting to swoop in so he can direct it.
Yeah,
maybe.
That would also be absolutely horrible. But anyways, next.
$20 million.
All I can say is no. I'm not surprised. Yeah. So. Moving on to something a little bit better.
So excited. Sort of. I don't know.
As I said, a little bit better. I mean, live action Akira being put on hold. Surprised. And I'm like, yeah, whatever. This is interesting. World War Z is being planned as a trilogy.
Yeah, I don't know if I'm okay with this, though. I'm sort of like, I know, I mean, it's a pretty epic novel.
Yes.
So there is a lot of material that they could go through. I just don't know how I feel about it being a trilogy and like having to wait any length of time between the movie. Like, to me, if they're going to do that and they want to put it all in, I'd almost say I'd rather see it as like a miniseries on television. Mm-hmm. You know, give me an hour, a couple hours a night for, 3 days.
Do we do those anymore?
They're not as common as they used to be, but yeah.
Like one of my favorite movies, quote unquote, is the sci-fi Dune series. miniseries.
Yeah.
Like, World War Z. No, I refuse to allow World War Z to be a direct to sci-fi.
Well, I'm not saying direct to sci-fi. I'm just talking about miniseries in general.
But
just saying that you can have great quality miniseries. The nice thing about miniseries is you can get the entire story out in a short amount of in a relatively short amount of time, and have still have the high quality without having to necessarily have, you know, have to worry too much about the distribution to movie theaters and that sort of thing. Although you don't get the ticket sales and such, but it helps you condense it, and then you don't have to worry about length. Essentially, it's okay. It's Earth. This whole thing is going to be a six hours, so it would be like three episodes of 6 hour movie or 2 hour features.
You got me. You got it.
I've honestly never. So if you made a joke about World War Z, I have no idea.
No, you just missed it. That's all.
Okay.
You just said you don't have to worry about length, and I said you just worry about girth. Joke.
Did that thump come through? Fine. Okay.
Yeah.
That's my head smacking the microphone.
Oh, was that so?
Okay. Yeah, I really need to get that from Audible.
But before we jump to the next story, the only thing I wanted to say was that I think we've seen from stuff like The Walking Dead, a good zombie thing can happen on television. So, you know, that's why I was kind of like, I don't know if I'd, you know, if it's going to work as a trilogy. I'm trying to think of like where the breakpoints would be. That's in that story.
Maybe they would essentially use an abridged version they did for the audiobook.
Well, it's mainly because of the way the story and the novel is structured. So they're really going to have to rework that in order to make it sort of make sense as breaking into a trilogy of movies.
Yeah. You know? If they're going to do kind of like the beginning of the war, and then kind of post-war or later, later in post-war, they could do a trilogy in that way. They would have to restructure the way the novel is kind of told.
Mm-hmm.
Wasn't it told like a series of interviews of survivors?
Yeah. And that's it. And it kind of went in and out of it wasn't necessarily in sequential order.
No.
It was very Tarantino.
Right, it's just people basically recalling their experiences. So, you know, I don't know.
Maybe they'll put in the more chronological sense where he's switching between interviews. Actually, no, he's not really doing that, is he?
And there's a couple people. Well, he does switch it between interviews because there's a couple of people that he talks to several times.
Right.
So they could do it in sequential order and kind of do the beginning, the middle, and an end to the zombie war.
But then rereading, you know, their description of the movie, it doesn't sound like they're actually doing it as people being interviewed.
Well, what they would have to do, they could probably do the beginning of the interview, but I'm sure that the interview is then going to flash to the live action of what was happening.
Yeah, which is pretty much what the book does too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it would be very cool that way. Like, I kept thinking about it, and I was just like, "Man, because I've listened to the book several times, because it's very hard once you get into Max Brooks. Like, it's totally like I could listen to his stuff all the time.
Right.
Very good. And I say listen because I'm not gonna lie to you. I own Zombie Survival Guide. I bought it when it first came out.
Mm-hmm.
And I loved it, but listening to the description of it, it's so much better to me than reading it. I guess I'm.
I listened to the audiobook of World War Z. I didn't read it, so.
Well, and the audiobook is great because it's got real actors doing.
But it's abridged. That's another problem.
Yeah.
But at the same time, that would be a thing. Like, they abridged the audiobook, which was 6 hours and 3 minutes long. But if they make this into a trilogy, well, that's like 3 2-hour films. And if they do the unabridged version, they essentially try not to abridge it at all. Then, I mean, if this was an unabridged audiobook, it would probably be, at least half to twice as long. So move that into movie terms where there's not a lot of, you know, that description writing and everything, where a lot of things can be told in a lot faster pace in a movie because you just see something versus
they're not having to describe it.
Yeah. Right. That it could be a lot faster. You would still have like 6 hours, maybe a couple of, maybe 2.5 hours on one of them to for length and still be able to fit it all within the trilogy and have it all. And then, yeah, the big problem would end up being where's the breaking point in these?
Right. I don't know. We'll see.
Yeah. I'm still excited about it.
Oh, I'm excited. I'm just kind of curious now as how they're going to pull it off, you know?
True.
Next up, Star Trek sequel will shoot in 2D and possibly IMAX and then be post-converted to 3D.
Yep.
I thought J.J. Abrams was partnering this. Although with the Star Wars movies coming out in 3D post-converted, Titanic coming out in 3D post-converted, which I just recently, or this morning, saw a preview for on the movie before the movie we watched. Maybe it's gonna have that high quality of 3D post conversion if why am I blanking on his name? Titanic director
Cameron.
Thank you.
Cameron. Yep.
It was coming to me just as you said it. And if George Lucas have really show that yes, you can post product convert and have a good movie, have a good 3D experience. I have my doubts.
Well, here's the thing. How did you feel about? Because he's directly comparing this conversion to Harry Potter. So we're shooting the film on 2D, and then we'll do a good high end conversion like the Harry Potter movie and all that.
I know. But,
luckily, with our release date now, we have the months needed to do it right. Because if you rush it, it never looks good. What I don't understand, and I don't know if it's just a timing thing or if it's a cost thing, but at this point in the game, if you really want to release a movie in 3D, I don't understand why they just don't shoot it in 3D.
Agreed. It's like they're obsessed with this post-conversion thing.
Well, that's why I want to know.
Because they already have 2D cameras and IMAX cameras. We've been shooting this for a long time. Why do we need to go 3D? And then we have to figure out how to shoot in 3D. Here's the thing: is if you're shooting in 2D to post convert to 3D, you have to still think about the 3D image when you're doing your 2D shooting.
Because
you have to think about what the final product is going to look like when you post convert it, and you know, why have to post-convert it, skip the step, go 3D when you shoot? Because you'll immediately be able to see if a shot looks right.
Mm.
You know, with everything digital nowadays, it shouldn't really matter. Pop on your Real-D 3D glasses and look at the monitor as it's being shot and check to see how it looks. And I would think that would be A, time-saving, and B, cheaper.
Right.
I could be completely and utterly wrong. I mean, who knows how much 3D camcorders or 3D film cameras are nowadays, especially if he wants to shoot in IMAX. That's another thing.
I'm looking through.
Interesting.
My only problem is I hate IMAX theaters.
Well, here's the thing, though. Here's the thing, because I originally thought, okay, IMAX, like, I immediately go to, like, the sort of, like, half-dome, like, at the museum sort of theater. But my theater has an IMAX screen, and it is not, like, that big. It's just, like, a giant regular screen. It's not crazy.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, the IMAX theater at the museum here, which is the only IMAX theater in town, has a similar type thing. The only thing is it's A, at the museum, which means that they have their whole museum, can't bring in food sort of policies, and the theaters are cramped like hell.
Oh, see,
you would hate being in this IMAX theater. You would absolutely despise it. It would detract you from it just detracts me from the movie from being it, even though I'm much easier sitting in those seats. It's crowded. It's cramped. You know, you can. When I went to see The Dark Knight at the IMAX theater, when was that a disappointment? The experience, not the movie. The movie was awesome, but it was just a terrible, terrible experience. I will never ever go see an IMAX movie. I would love to if the Alamo Drafthouse fitted one of their screens with an IMAX screen. I'm there, but it needs to be comfortable. And I need to be able to have my popcorn and soda, you know, at least, you know, as I said, I'd prefer to be at the Alamo Drafthouse and have like a nice pizza or beer. But that's beside the point. I need a comfortable IMAX experience. Otherwise, it is not worth it to go see it. And sometimes I just feel like the screen's too big. Sure, it's kind of like a regular screen, except bigger, which usually just involves adding height to it. You know, it actually reduces or changes the more towards a 4x3 format versus a 16x9.
Well, it's 180 millimeter or something? Isn't that what makes IMAX IMAX?
Well, that's the film.
I understand that. Mm-hmm. That's pretty much what sets
big film. but here's the thing is on film, on the same film, you can shoot a 16x9 framed image, or you can shoot a 4x3 framed image.
Yes.
And that same exact type of film. So it's a lot taller, allows for a lot better resolution on a much bigger screen, is all what IMAX does. So yep. That's it.
I found an interesting point to add to the whole Star Trek combination. We had had a discussion earlier about Benicio del Toro.
Mm-hmm.
He's apparently out. He quit.
Didn't we discover that last week or something?
Maybe. I don't remember if we said it, but.
Oh, maybe it's somewhere else, but.
Edgar Ramirez or Jordi Molla are said to be up for the part. Molla was in Colombiana, and Ramirez was in Oliver Assayas's miniseries Carlos. I don't know what that is.
Wait a minute. Okay, hold on. I'm sensing accents here, and the only thing that I can think of dealing with accents is Khan. I'm very disappointed. unless they're finding the Botany Bay and it's basically Space Seed in the alternate reality.
They don't know. Well, what it says in this article that's linked on the other one, it says, although Montalban, who made him famous, was of Latin descent, as are the other actors in question, the character of Khan is originally intended to be of Indian ancestry.
Correct.
So in the Star Trek universe, Khan was a genetically engineered tyrant who seized control of much of the Earth in the 90s during a conflict known as the Eugenics Wars.
His name is Khan Noonien Singh.
Correct. At the conclusion of the reign, Khan escaped to Earth in a starship, the Botany Bay, and was held in suspended animation with his crew until he was found and revived in 2267 by Captain James T. Kirk.
Space Seed.
As a point of reference, the Abrams film, the original Abrams film, is set in 2258, though in a diverging timeline. So in theory, Khan could have been awakened as far as back as 2233 when Nero first arrived, and from then on altered history.
Point.
So there.
But he hasn't met Kirk.
Right.
So there cannot be a Wrath of Khan until at least you've had the meeting of Khan and Kirk. And that meeting has to go bad. Because they could meet, and then it actually ends up being really good or something. And then there is no Wrath of Khan.
All right. So perhaps there's no Khan at all. So that's a moot point. So there's no telling. Who knows?
You know, I think one thing will stay consistent. The fact that I think the Botany Bay is still out there, and Khan is still alive yet sleeping. So he just needs to be found. And he's going to be found by James T. Kirk, so there's still going to be parallels, but it's going to be a different type of encounter.
Cool. Well,
and Khan will end up being pissed off. Anyways.
Speaking of tyrants,
hmm.
I found this very interesting. This was just something I found today as we were looking through the stuff that just came out today. Joel Edgerton is officially signed on for Catherine Bigelow's unnamed Bin Laden film.
Really?
Yes. Now, I knew really? That this was – that's why I said this hat – you knew it was coming.
Really?
Apparently, Catherine Bigelow of Hurt Locker fame
mm-hmm.
Was actually doing a movie about Black Ops Navy SEALs. But it was recently updated to include the successful operation that took down Osama bin Laden. So as of right now, her plan is to have a movie out by December 19th.
I don't know. This doesn't bode well.
Yeah.
Sure, the Hurt Locker was amazing, and I think they won the Academy Award that year, but...
Yeah. I'm curious. There's another... Oh, crap. I don't remember the name of the movie now. I saw the trailer, too. Hold on. Act of Valor. When is that coming out?
Because
that's another, like, Navy SEAL, like, you know, they use real Navy SEALs to shoot it.
Oh, right. They did.
February 24th.
Yep. Okay. So I'm just, like, wondering if it's, like, everybody's, like, rushing to try to get some sort of Navy SEAL movie in there. I don't know.
I knew – the reason I put that on here is, that, like, I knew it was going to happen sooner or later. Somebody was going to do a movie about the bin Laden issue.
I figured it would just be much later.
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly what I'm saying too. But now they're updating a movie. Yeah, now they're going to update a movie, and Catherine Bigelow is going to take it and try to win another Oscar.
Yeah, let's just rile up the extremists that hate us already by making a movie about it. It's like, ugh.
Time for our victory dance.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I figured this was going to bring up at this stage.
Brilliant.
Here we go.
Just brilliant. Moving on into the past.
You're telling me you built a time machine out of a DeLorean?
I think I need to check these results. Casablanca from 1942. I say Casablanca. I don't know. Casablanca. Tomato. 97% fresh. I think it's actually 97% audience, isn't it?
I don't know. I don't.
I think it was both. I must have mistyped them. I'm going to double check to make sure. Directed by Michael Curtis. It was starring Humphrey Bogart, Ingrid Bergman, and Paul Henreid.
Indeed. So I sort of made an unofficial New Year's resolution a while back before the new year to say I was going to start watching... a whole bunch of movies that I felt, as somebody who considers themselves a film sort of fan and buff, movie buff, that I really have no excuse for not watching at some point in my life. And Casablanca was one of them. It was one of the ones on the top of the list because it's on the top of a lot of lists.
Agreed.
So it's number two on AFI's top 100.
Mm-hmm.
100 years, 100 movies.
Right.
It was a little
so bit the sheer fact that there's like so many little sort of pop culture references to this, you know, this film. There's so many lines, you know, I went through and tried to figure out as many as I could. You know, of course, there's some I find humorous is that there's a bunch that are like misquoted. Like the infamous "Play It Again, Sam," never said it in the movie ever. They came close.
Are you sure that was from this?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's actually a big trivia item on a lot of the pages about the movie that it's been misquoted. And the other one is the Louis. I think this is the beginning of a beautiful friendship, which is often misquoted too. They actually said that, but people say, like, you know, I think this is the beginning of, you know,
It's slightly set wrong.
Yes, all over the place.
But it's basically the same thing. This is the beginning of a beautiful...
Here's another one. We'll Always Have Paris. I had no idea that that was from this movie. I did know Here's Looking at You, Kid, though, was from this one. Looking at you,
kid. And he said it like three times.
Yes, yes.
Which sounded odd.
I did not know, and I'd heard this many times before, the of all the gin joints in all the towns in all the world... You know, mm-hmm. It's been modified many times to different stories, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't really know that that one was from this one. And then the other sort of weird one was the I stick my neck out for nobody. I didn't really know that that was like a famous line.
Yeah, I didn't either.
Yeah. So I think that one should be a little lower on the list than all these other ones. And then, of course, there's the classic song. As time goes by, and I didn't look to see. Did anybody look to see what number one was?
Of the 100 songs.
Yeah, 100 years, 100 songs.
100 years, 100 songs. 100 years. Here it is.
Yeah, somebody looked that up.
Over the Rainbow from Wizard of Oz.
Okay. Yeah. So, I just was amazed at that. And the other thing that I sort of felt when I watched this is when I tried to watch this originally was many, many, many years ago. I think I was trying to watch it on VHS or something, or maybe cable. I don't remember. And I was much younger, and my sort of irrational hatred of anything old and black and white was sort of interfering with my enjoyment of the movie. Mm-hmm. So, being a lot older and a little bit wiser, I think I've enjoyed this film a whole lot more this time through. I actually made it through the whole movie and sort of came to appreciate the subject matter a little more, I think.
I'll be honest that I had no real idea what the whole movie was about. I'd never seen it from start to end.
I didn't either. I never finished watching
it. Yeah, so, but even the beginning, I didn't mm-hmm. kind of realize what the topic was about.
Ah, okay.
I just thought it was a love story kind of thing, like he's in Casablanca, she comes to Casablanca to find him. I just thought that was about what it was about, but
right
now I have a better understanding of what the whole movie was about, because it was talking about how people were leaving France to escape Nazi Germany,
mm-hmm.
the takeover, you know, and how everybody made it down there and all that kind of stuff. And they were trying to use Casablanca to get to other places, mm-hmm. you know, and be safe and all that kind of stuff. And I didn't realize that was what that was all about.
Yeah. I never knew that it was like a World War II flick. Basically.
Yeah. I never really put all that together. Mm-hmm. So now actually having watched it all the way through, it made sense. Like I enjoyed the movie.
Mm-hmm.
And I say that, and, you know, as much as I enjoy 1940s movies, you know, and I only say that because it's not that I dislike 1940s movies. I'm not a fan of the acting. And I realize that that's because a lot of people come from stage and all that kind of stuff. And we've talked about this before a little bit. But
well, yeah, those movies definitely have a different feel to them than modern films. You can tell. Yeah. Even if, you know, they weren't ever shot in black and white and they were, you know, they just have a different feeling mm-hmm. when you watch an older movie.
Yeah, because you have Sam and, you know, in there as well. And you have, like, Rick talking to him and Ingrid Bergman's character talking to him. And then all of a sudden he's like, yes, sir, Mr. Rick. You know, and I'm like, oh, Lord. You know, yeah. It's just that kind of the minstrel quality of the black actor in the movie.
Who fake played piano really horribly.
Yeah, exactly.
I didn't even notice.
Yeah.
Oh, I always noticed. Because I play guitar, I'm always like super conscious of like, is that person really playing or not? Like, and then it's like, oh, he's obviously not playing. And they had the actual guy on set playing the piano, like hidden off screen so that he could watch him play and try to emulate his actual hand movements, which he did a horrible job of. But the guy was a musician. He was a drummer.
Yeah.
So at least he was some sort of musician. So I have props to him for that.
Person.
Yeah.
Exactly.
But there were a couple funny things that I found, like that Mr. Bogart had to wear platform shoes because I guess Ingrid Bergman's a lot taller than him.
Yeah.
Nice.
I don't know how much taller, but I think that's pretty funny. You know, these two sort of iconic romance characters. And I was just thinking it would have been that thing if they would have just left it alone and he would have been a lot shorter than her, if it would have paid off.
Right.
Yeah, think about him looking up at her, saying, "Here's looking mm-hmm. at you, kid."
Right.
I don't think that would work so well. He needs to kind of have that, you know, slight look down, even if it's just an inch or two taller, you know.
A couple other things is that first of all, that this was one of those they never played together in another movie. As popular as this movie was. And I think it's sort of unusual for that time period, because I think Hollywood is very much of like, you know, let's throw these two actors together in as much things as we possibly can to cash in on their success. But they never, ever played in another movie together. Oh. And Humphrey Bogart didn't live much longer after that. I think it was like another 10 years and he was dead. So, and I remember going through the IMDb listing of all the actors, and it seemed like a lot of the actors died at the same time. Like, they all seemed to drop dead in their 50s. So let's hear it for, like, bad diets and heart attacks. Yay.
Yep.
And smoking.
Yep.
Other interesting thing, that much like The Empire Strikes Back, nobody knew the actual... how the film was going to end. They kept it a secret until the final scene was actually shot, which was so weird to me, because it wasn't like this was like an anticipated film or like they were afraid the secret was going to get out. So I don't know if they thought that would help them with the sort of acting of the story. I don't know.
Huh.
Director's choice or something.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely interesting.
Or they were taking their time writing and they hadn't actually finished it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, never know. Maybe they were waiting to see how the war went in certain places.
So
maybe.
Do you think this is a movie that? Do you think this is a movie that anybody's ever going to try to directly remake or emulate directly, like completely rip it off?
I wouldn't think so.
No?
Yeah, I wouldn't think so. It's like trying to do a remake of Citizen Kane,
mm-hmm.
You know, in this movie. And I think it's just too classic.
The only way you could really remake it is trying to do a shot-for-shot remake, for example, like kind of like Psycho. You know,
yeah.
And trying to do the exact same thing, except in color, new actors, and different... you know, that more advanced set building and staging or what have you. They'll do it actually, instead of on a soundstage, they'll actually do it in Morocco or something.
Yeah.
Right.
And who would you get to play the characters? Because it would have to be, I mean, those were two of the biggest actors ever at that time.
First thing that comes to my mind, though, it wouldn't be kind of like the really big actors or anything. Strangely enough, I don't know where this comes from. It just kind of popped into my head. But the first person that comes into mind to play Rick is Alec Baldwin.
Hmm.
I'm not sure if that's necessarily...
He's become right, so for comedic. Some reason, he's become comedy so much lately. I don't know that he would fit that anymore.
Yeah,
well, I'm thinking more along the lines of like The Shadow.
Yeah, I'm thinking of... And this is probably a bad choice too, but the person who immediately comes to mind when I think of sort of like somebody who's good at playing sort of an anti-hero guy who can play aloof when it comes to like a woman is like George Clooney. Like,
Oh, yeah.
You know,
I don't know what Kevin Costner is stuck in my head for some reason.
Yeah. But, the funny thing, though, is that one of the little bits, and this was actually in the trivia, but I moved it down to here because I wanted to talk about it and make sure I didn't miss it, was that I guess in the 80s, somebody actually sent the script out to a bunch of studios, but they took Casablanca off it and put the original title of the play that it was, Everybody Comes to Rick's, and some people recognize it, but most of them didn't, which I find funny, seeing that it's nice. Like this huge iconic Hollywood film. And they all many complained that the script was not good enough to make a decent movie. Others gave such complaints as too dated and too much dialogue and not enough sex.
Sex. Nice.
And which is funny because, you know, you come to think about it, there's really no sex in this movie at all. And this movie's all about sort of like that, you know, that whirlwind romance and two ex sort of lovers coming back together in an unexpected situation and the tension that, you know, is there from the previous relationship. And so the funny,
well, and I wondered, and you guys, maybe somebody can clarify this for me.
Mm-hmm.
I know how, do you think that Ingrid Bergman's, what's her name in the movie? I'm forgetting. Ingrid Bergman. Anyway, yes. When she comes in, Elsa. Okay. When she comes in, do you think she knows where she's going? Or do you think that when she gets in there and somebody says that it's owned by Rick and stuff, and she puts two and two together, that, you know, that's just where this kind of leads off? Or do you think she intentionally knew that this is where he was?
I'm of the school of thought that she didn't know.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, she could be lying to him, but she does say in it that if I knew you were here, I would have never come.
Yeah, that's true.
So, but she could be lying, you know, who knows?
Yeah.
She lied about being married. So why couldn't she lie about, you know,
good point. Cause I was going to give her credit. I couldn't remember from watching it, but I was going to give her credit for being kind of a woman out to try to find the guy that she lost or whatever, you know, or, you know, that kind of thing. But if it was all an accident, then I don't give her any credit.
Yeah, I think that's what sort of, I think now, you know, because when I first tried to watch this movie, I'd never been in a relationship or had an old relationship, you know, to worry about with somebody. So this, like the whole like, oh, somebody just walked in that, you know, you had a relationship with and, you know, didn't end well, you know, like I couldn't relate to that at all when I first watched it. And now I totally can relate to it, you know, with the experience that I've had. And so I think that sort of helps resonate the story with me. Like I get it, you know, I get it a little more. One of the things, though, that I found, like, there's the scene where you've got the German Nazis all start singing the German, I don't know if it's a drinking song or what, but they're all, you know, doing their German song in the bar. And then the Laszlo strikes up the band and everybody in the place to start singing the French national anthem.
Yes.
That, you know, everybody in that. Well, a lot of people that were in that cast as extras and stuff were actually people that had fled from Nazi Germany and France. One of the people was the waiter in the movie. He was in a movie that we'd seen earlier, The Christmas in Connecticut. Well, I saw.
I recognized him.
Who he had actually fled from Nazi Germany, and his two sisters had died in concentration camps. So when you see a lot of people in tears while they're singing that song, that those tears were not acting tears. They were like actual really crying, singing that, doing that scene. So there's a lot of realism there in that scene, which kind of comes through, I think, a little bit. Just a little interesting. You know, it's kind of weird to think that they were doing a movie about, you know, Nazi Germany while the war was going on, and that there were people that were actually in that situation, you know.
Well, they kept the story mostly away from the German occupation directly. You know, there was the reasons why they fled, but they don't really talk much more about that. Just there's some Nazi control in the area, and here's some things that happened in that area, and there were some Germans.
Well, it was actually one of the first movies to have a anti-Nazi sort of message in it. And Warner Brothers was one of the first studios to actually take that stand and refuse to have any of their movies shown in Nazi Germany. Like, they wouldn't distribute anything to Germany or any of the German-controlled countries at the time. So it was very much sort of it was sort of groundbreaking in that sense that a company or a studio had said, you know, no, we're going to make this movie and have, you know, we're going to actually not go out of our way, but we're going to portray, you know, the Nazis in a not a good light, you know, that people are scared of them and running away from them. And so that was an interesting sort of thing too, that I read in the trivia.
Understandable.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. So that is Casablanca. But what have we learned? We have learned that Morocco is full of vultures. Vultures, vultures everywhere. It's okay to be a parasite, just not a cut-rate one. A winning side pays much better, maybe. Drunkard makes you a citizen of the world. You get much more than a penny for your thoughts in France. No one is supposed to sleep well in Casablanca. Friends of Rick get the special discount. And the problems of three people don't mount to a hill of beans in this crazy world. And that is what we've learned from Casablanca. So there is a reason that this is number two on AFA's top 100 movies and number three on the 10th anniversary edition of the list. Brilliant storytelling of the era, and the acting was wonderful. Everybody should see this at least once. Some people may be turned off due to the black and white style and the acting style from the time, but it's definitely earned its place on AFI's list.
Yeah. And like I said, I attempted to watch this movie once before when I was much, much younger, and I didn't make it through. And now that I'm sort of, you know, I'm older and, like I said, a little wiser, I enjoyed this movie a lot more. I could relate to it. So I think everybody should watch or at least attempt to watch this movie. Give it a chance. If only for seeing where all these crazy little influential pop culture things come from, you know.
I agree. First time I'd watched it from the beginning to end, and I liked actually being able to see where some of that pop culture came from and fit into the movie, because I'd always seen it out of context before.
Mm-hmm.
I actually liked it. I liked the movie, and actually found myself rooting for Rick throughout the movie. So, you know, just to being kind of the good guy, protector, and, you know, trying to keep people in his place, you know, everything kind of legit, even if it wasn't legit. Mm-hmm. You know, he was trying to save face and protect people. And yes. I actually liked his character. So there we go.
Excellent.
Yep.
Moving on into the present.
When does this happen in the movie?
Now. You're looking at now, sir. Everything that happens now is happening now.
War Horse. This is the one which matches. 77% fresh, 77% audience. So it looks like the credits and the audience agreed this time around. Directed by Steven Spielberg. Hey, our present movie was directed by Steven Spielberg last week, too.
Mm-hmm.
Starring Jeremy Irvine, Emily Watson, and David Ulis. I didn't recognize Emily Watson.
Who was she? Emily Watson?
Yeah. Which one was she? Was she the girl with her grandpa?
I'm imagining so.
Are you thinking of Emma Watson?
Yeah, different person.
I think you're thinking of...
Yeah. Oh, okay, never mind. No, never mind.
You're thinking of Emma Watson.
Emma Watson.
Yeah, David Thewlis is the only Harry Potter expatriate we have joining us in this film. So... and was he plays, is it just me or can David, he can really play a guy you like to hate really well. Like, and well, going through another,
wasn't Neville Longbottom in it? Wasn't he, one of the soldiers?
Maybe.
I thought he was one of the soldiers.
No.
I wasn't paying that much too much attention to it, but I could have sworn that I could be
I'm
wrong.
I'm gonna find out.
Go ahead. Yeah. So crazy thing, this was a children's novel, sort of strange, I guess. Not what I would think of as. I mean, the horse part of it, yes, but the whole fact that it was, you know, based in World War One, and I don't know if some of this content was embellished for the movie or it was the violence was ramped up for the movie, but there's some pretty strong subject material in this.
Yeah.
So I'm curious. I'm going to have to see if I can find like a synopsis of the novel and see how much of it was actually in this, you know? So going into this, I mean, obviously Steven Spielberg film. So I expect it to be shot really well. It did have a Steven Spielberg-y feel to it, especially the signature sort of, he loves those crane shots coming over a hill and revealing a huge thing and music swells. And, you know, he's got that in all his movies. We saw it in, Tintin last week, and we're seeing it again here. But there were some scenes, like there's a couple things that I really want to know how they pulled off. Like the scene that was sort of put in the trailer with the horse running through the battlefield and through the barbed wire. Like that scene had me like in my seat, sort of like curled up in a ball, like, ow, ouch. I'm like, oh my God, horse is going through. Oh, I felt so bad for that poor horse.
There had to be a bunch of CG which ended up turning out really, really good or something.
I don't know how they I want to know how they did that scene, really. I mean, when that thing hit and the horse flipped over, I was like,
I couldn't believe that Joey kept trying to run, as you know, until he got completely tangled up in the barbed wire. He just ran through barbed wire. I was like, I almost was like, well, maybe he was going to jump over it, but he doesn't. He just runs right through it.
Yeah. Well, here's, I have to admit something here. I'm not a fan of horses. Like, I don't know. I've never been a fan of horses. I've always been a little freaked out by horses. I always thought they were like this really big, sort of dumb animal that could kick me and kill me. Like, just, I don't know. I've always had this thing about horses. I never really liked them. So for me to sort of be sympathetic to these horses in this movie, I was just like, you know, I was all about that. And I was actually surprised. I know I picked this film, but I was not really looking forward to seeing it. I felt for some reason that I had to put it on the list. Like, I would have regretted us not talking about it, and I didn't know if anybody else was going to put it on, so that's kind of the reason why I threw it on here. But I, you know, like I said, it's a Spielberg film. It's shot beautifully. Mm-hmm. I'm not even sure who the cinematographer was. One of the things that I found interesting, though, was sort of the hidden violence factor.
Yeah.
Like, he sort of, like, ramped the violence of the movie up very slowly. Like, every time that somebody died, it was hidden or off screen for quite a while. You know, the scene with the machine guns, you saw the guys on the horses, and then the horses without the guys on their backs, but you never saw anybody actually getting shot. When the two German guys, the deserters, got caught and they were shot, it was covered by the blades of the windmill.
That was clever.
Yeah, that was done really well.
I mean, it was like first you see them, it goes over, bang, and then it kind of reveals them lying on the ground.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so
I just found a funny article, not to stop the flow.
Uh-huh.
Emily Watson, Warhorse star, is not Emma Watson and has never been in a Harry Potter movie. You're thinking of Emma Watson. It's totally an article that is hilarious.
That's funny. Sorry. That's funny. That's okay. But one of the biggest complaints I got from everybody that I had talked to that had seen this movie, my parents went and saw this, and my sister went and saw this. they, especially my sister, found the first 30, 35 minutes of the movie extremely boring. Mm-hmm. So the whole sort of like scene, the scenes of his like relationship with the horse, like him getting to know the horse and training the horse and all that, she was just like, all right, I'm done with this. Now, did you guys feel the same way? Or did you feel, I felt that that sort of, okay, it was a little slow, but I felt it was necessary.
I agree. I mean, there might have been some way of speeding it up, but.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, if they could have sped it up a little, I wouldn't have objected. But I feel that the actual showing that relationship is really sort of important to the rest of the movie. Or at least to the ending of the movie, to the sort of payoff, I think.
Mm-hmm.
You know? The emotional payoff or lack the emotional manipulation, as I think Steve is going to talk about.
Oh my God.
So let us know. Yeah. Steven.
Yeah.
What's up?
Just that. Okay. I, you know what? As soon as I got out of the theater, I just kept thinking, I'm like, this is fucking Crash with a horse. Cause you know, if you ever saw Crash,
yeah, I never saw it.
How they all interact with each other in different uh-huh. ways
uh-huh.
throughout the entire movie.
Uh-huh.
And this was just like Crash in that the horse was the common thread.
Right.
Do you know what I'm saying? Because, but, you know, like, you know, the farm boy had interacted with the soldier. And then the soldier got killed. So, and he had sort of interacted with the German soldiers. The German soldiers, you know, hide out in the barn. There's all these things that are coming together, and I'm like, it was kind of like Crash, mm-hmm. just that the central thing that pulled them all together was this horse was around. Right. So, you know, and I just felt it very contrived.
Okay.
In a lot of ways, like just the emotional. I mean, like, really, for real, this could have really happened. You know what I mean? Like, that's all that I was. You know, I know suspension of disbelief and or suspension of belief and all that stuff. I should be able to do that.
Mm-hmm.
But I thought it was going to be different. You know, I thought it was going to be the horse goes off into the war. Then we see what happens to the horse at war and then he comes back.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? That kind of thing. But I didn't think it was going to be all this random. The horse got owned by seven different people and, you know, I don't know. It just felt very manipulative. Okay. And everything was very much like, and they wanted you to let Emily have the horse because she was sickly, you know, and she just wanted to teach it how to jump so bad, you know? And so you thought, you know, I was going to be honest with you. I thought that they were going to end up teaching it how to jump.
Mm-hmm.
That she was going to end up teaching it how to jump so that it learned another skill. And then it jumped over the tank,
mm-hmm.
you know, and then I thought it was going to end up jumping over the barbed wire, to be honest with you, but it didn't.
Yeah, I agree.
You know, but it was just manipulative.
Mm-hmm.
And like it was set up just to elicit an emotional reaction.
Right. Well, I definitely would say that. The book ending of the film, as far as you have this boy who, you know, I won't say fell in love with this horse, but built this relationship with this horse.
I figured he was going to be blind and never, that would have made my day.
Oh, if he would have missed the horse? Like,
yeah, if he would have been blinded by that stuff and he would have never seen the horse or the, you know, or whatever, or he was blind for the rest of his life and he could never see the horse.
Mm-hmm.
I would have been like, that's ironic.
Right.
But instead, regained his eyesight and went back to, you know, just, I mean, it would have been like, I mean, if he had stayed blind, that would have been more emotional manipulation. Yes. I think Spielberg was going to go there.
To me, I mean, I sort of see where you're coming from. And there is one point, there's one part of the story where I did sort of do like an eye roll where it was kind of like, oh, come on now, which was when he started whistling for the horse.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, I actually thought that was going to happen earlier in the when the two sides were, the German and the Allied side were trying to call the horse when he was stuck in the barbed wire. that's when I actually thought that was going to happen. That I thought he was going to, you know, gotcha. They're all trying to call the horse and it wasn't working. Then he was going to be like, here, I'll try my call to see if it works.
Yeah.
You know? But when he did that in the hospital, when he was blind and he did like the walk through all the people, that was when I was kind of like, oh, come on.
Yeah. Yeah.
That was my like, okay, now they're messing with us here.
I really would have. Yeah. I would prefer that scene to be more of he hears and then he slowly just starts walking towards people and pushing them aside, mm-hmm. trying to get to the source, and he just continues here. And then he comes up, he's still lying to him, he's whistling, he's still lying on a bed, and he comes mm-hmm. up and nuzzles him or something.
Yeah. Because how annoying was that, really, when it's like, and he's got four white socks and a white, you know, mm-hmm. spot on his head. You know, whatever. You know, and
it was a Scottish accent, not a Cockney accent. Get it okay. right.
Right, whatever. He's my horse.
Well, it was Irish, okay. actually. It was Irish yes. guineas.
But still.
And I meant that in the point. Monetary sense, not in the bad yeah. racial term sense.
Right. But when it did that, and then all of a sudden it was like the black was just on his spot. The black mud was just on his socks. You know, like come on. You know,
so we had lost Steven at that point.
No, because I was listening to the poor girl behind me sobbing her ass off.
Well, I will admit I cried a couple times.
I got close okay. to it.
I did well up in a couple of scenes. But again, like I said, I felt forced. To well up, like Spielberg had put, like this is a point where people are gonna cry.
Mm-hmm.
Like it wasn't like I didn't feel like it was natural. It was like, oh, ow, oh, oh, oh. You know, like
the scene that got me was the very end, and funny enough, you know, that had really nothing to do with the horse. Was the son sort of coming back home and you know, bringing out the banner. From his father, and there's sort of that yeah. moment of realization on the father's like, you understand, like we have this connection now because we have both been through an experience,
right? We know? Have a connection that we never had shared before, and now we right.
that got me. That was the thing that pushed me over the edge. So of course I'm trying to walk out of the theater right without everybody seeing that I'm fucking like, you know, got tears in my eyes. You're like, oh god.
I will admit this is another part of the manipulation that I'm talking mm-hmm. about was of course Emily's dead. Why else would you be buying the horse? You know, like when he came up there and he was and the guy buys the horse
right.
and then says he wants to give it to his granddaughter, bought it for his granddaughter, and they're like, where is your granddaughter? I'm like, she's dead. I just said it in my head, you know, I'm like, she's dead. And then he's just like, the wolf took everything from me, you know. And I'm like, right. Oh Lord, that's enough of emotional manipulation, Spielberg. That is not fair at all.
Maybe he was just being true to the source material, though. I don't know.
Yeah, maybe.
So there was another little interesting point of discussion about. Do you think that she died? Like she was killed because of the war? Do you think she died because, you know, they kept hinting that she was sick and she was taking right. medicine?
Well, I think he's going to say it's the war because maybe they had taken all their stuff.
Right.
You know, and so maybe it's not that she didn't get killed by a bomb or anything like that, but she might have died because they didn't have the medications. They didn't have the things that they needed to keep her alive.
Right.
I have a feeling that he's meaning more than that. Mm-hmm. More in that realm than they had come and taken her or anything like mm-hmm. that.
Right.
And maybe you guys can help me out. This is really just me being a horny bastard, but the guy who played the private, who was sort of like the horse guy when they were pulling the artillery, the mm-hmm. one who like sympathized with the horses.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Does anybody yeah. know who that was?
The big German guy?
Yeah, I had to, like I said, I was like, you know, trying to get out of the theater fast, so I didn't have time to sit there and watch the credits.
What was his name?
Well, it was Private something, but I could never catch his name because of the, And I couldn't find him in or anything that looked like that in IMDb. So I'm like, oh no, who is he?
He's probably one of the ones that doesn't have a picture.
Yeah. So
that's the hard part. I'm trying. That's why I'm having the issue with my cross check on Harry Potter as well.
Yeah, definitely.
So,
yeah, he can be my private. Anyways.
Mm-hmm. Oh, God.
What have we learned from this movie? We've learned if you're going to plow, you need something solid.
Amen.
There are big days and...
What do you know about it?
Okay.
Right into the gutter. Anyway,
there are big days and there are small days. There aren't words for some things. Any for innuendos in all of these. It's good to be proud when you've done something good. I might hate you more, but I'll never love you less.
That was my favorite line.
Favorite line from the movie. Yep.
Absolutely. I heard it and I was like, that's a quote.
I'm so stealing that.
Time spent on reconnaissance is time rarely wasted. The Germans spent their time in trenches reading books and knitting sweaters. And the women in Italy are not as good as the food.
And apparently neither are German women.
Yeah.
Because that was actually a funny little exchange there.
Yes.
And that is what we've learned from War Horse. Brilliant epic, and I think a return to form for Spielberg, well, in live-action sense at least, considering he did come back to form with Tintin, but that was animated. Definitely worth seeing, but maybe more of a movie night at home versus the theater. It's just because it wasn't my style of movie. I liked the movie, it was good, but not something that I would normally go see in the theaters.
Mm-hmm.
So I wouldn't say I'm disappointed in any way, shape, or form. It was well worth the however much I spent to go see this movie. But I think people would be okay to stay at home, cuddle on the couch with a loved one, and watch the movie on a nice 46-inch or more plus TV.
Did you say 6-inch?
No, I said 46-inch. 46-inch!
Again, beautifully shot. I think I've said that like 5 times already. I think you have to give the movie time to sort of engage you, because like I said, some people feel the beginning slow. I was all for the emotional manipulation. I fell into Spielberg's traps. And I don't even like horses, so take that as you will. Go see it. Is it worth seeing in the theater? Maybe, you know, it's a pretty epically shot movie, so yeah. I think it plays well on a big screen.
I'd give it that. I'd give it worth seeing in the theater for the scale,
mm-hmm.
and kind of the larger than life stuff. Especially the war scenes were actually really well done. You know,
and there's not a whole lot of war scenes in it. That's what's interesting. Like,
well, no,
not...
but they look good.
Oh yeah,
you know, and the larger screen versus having to watch them on your TV.
Yes.
I'm gonna say okay. The scenery was amazing. The story was annoying. I didn't hate it like I thought I would, because I was gonna be honest with you, Fuzz, that I was I was ready to press send on a status that said I hate you, Ray Medrano.
Wouldn't be the first time I've gotten those tags.
Right, I know, but I was about to tell you, I was about to do this and being like, why did you waste my evening?
Just remember, Fuzz, he'll hate you more, but he will never love you less.
I know.
Exactly. That was gonna be my thing. But I didn't hate it as much as I thought I would.
Mm.
But I did feel emotionally raped afterwards, because I felt like it was forcing me to be emotional.
Mm-hmm.
And eliciting emotional responses from the audience rather than just naturally doing it. It kind of kept putting all these situations and unrealistic spins on things to kind of force you to want to cry.
Mm-hmm.
And it, like I said, I just also felt like it was crashed with horses.
Gotcha.
So a quick thing here. Favorite scene, the wire cutters being thrown out.
Yeah.
Hey, I
yeah,
need some more cute. Wire cutters. Yeah. There's like six of them thrown over. And it's not like they popped up and threw them or something. They're just like thrown over. Worst shot, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. It was a nice scene, but worst shot, in my opinion, was the final scenes, because they were obviously done on a sound stage.
Well, they very much had that old-fashioned sepia sort of tone to them.
I can guarantee that scene was done on a sound stage.
Green screen behind
them. Yes.
Yeah. You could see every once in a while, you could kind of tell that scenery was not what was behind them.
Honestly, that scene could have been done the old-fashioned way, where they basically had a backdrop, mm-hmm. basically matte painting of the sun behind them, and then they just did some dramatic orange lighting. Well, actually, they did do dramatic orange lighting.
Yes, they did.
And it was on an actual thing, not like it was a green screen and then they put it in post. I wouldn't be surprised if Spielberg actually did that.
but I'm thinking he did it on purpose. To me, it felt like something he was doing on purpose. Like
it felt.
There
so
were a lot of them
for all the other scenes, though.
There was a lot of. There were several scenes where I kept thinking, "This is on a green screen.
Mm-hmm.
This is what's behind them. Is not what's behind them."
Right.
And I was surprised to catch that in myself. You know, but
yeah.
I mean, it cool, is.
But the ending especially, I it almost felt like he was doing it on purpose. Like it was like I'm placing it in a certain era of film by doing our version of the backdrop, which is, you know, green screen. You know.
So
the lighting was so obviously not natural. You know.
Yeah. It was a good scene. It just took me out. It just kind of took me out of
the, I guess this. It's good because you didn't have that much longer to go.
That's true. But anyways, so that is War Horse. Moving on into the future.
Hi. Welcome to the future. And I'm telling you, it's great here.
Prometheus. Being released June 8th, 2012. Directed by Ridley Scott, starring Noomi Rapace, Charlize Theron, Patrick Wilson. A team of explorers discover a clue to the origins of mankind on Earth, leading them on a journey into the darkest corners of the universe. There, they must fight a terrifying battle to save the future of the human race. Ooh.
Yes.
It has absolutely nothing to do with Alien, except that it takes place in the
same universe.
That's right. That's it. That's the only connection between the two movies.
Oh, there's
and it will
until you greatly, look at the trailer. Yeah.
And it will greatly reference that movie.
Oh yes.
So that first off the title appearing, I mean, they put it in here title scroll or whoever typed this and put it in as title scroll, but the title slowly appearing just one piece of a letter at a time.
Yep.
Stone edifice that looked like the egg chamber, which. When you look closely, they're not actually eggs.
Right. Just
But they look that way. The space jockey head chair. I miss that one.
Okay. It's in the, you see it coming up and out.
Well, there's two things. There's actually, you know what? I'll see if I can put the link to it in here. There's a really awesome video by the guys at IGN, the IGN Rewind go through, you know, frame by frame and point out all the little things that are from Alien in some way. There's two things with the space jockey. One is you'll see them doing some sort of medical examination in a medical bay, and there's a head on the table, and the head looks very much like the space jockey head from the original movie.
Okay.
And then you do see the chair
rising,
the space jockey chair coming up out of the ground and sort of rotating into position. That you see, you know, frozen with the dead space jockey in the original Alien.
Is that the really big guy that was the space jockey?
Yes, that they're known as the space jockeys.
I did not know that. I learned something.
You do. There's the sort of a reminiscent scene of the sort of acid-y, smoking acid damage going on to somebody's helmet. Although it looks like it's inside the helmet. So we don't know what that is. The first thing I completely picked up on, though, after the title scroll thing, though, was there's a sound effect in the original Alien trailer that is used in the Prometheus trailer to the same sort of effect, where it's sort of like a repeating sort of scream that happens at a rhythm.
Oh.
And that happens in this trailer, too. So I would probably say that we should probably put the original Alien trailer up so people can look at both. And you'll really see some of the, you'll audibly pick up on some of the similarities between this trailer and the Alien trailer. So, and of course, there is the ship that has crashed on LV-426. We see that ship at the end of the trailer or the teaser, whatever you want to call it. And it is very obviously the same ship from Alien that they discover. So, yes, it's in some ways a prequel, as in events in this movie happened prior to the events in Alien, but we don't really know how the story is going to interweave and around and before that film.
Right. At what point does it catch up or...
Right.
You know, or establish stuff for the second.
Yes.
Kind of like maybe it's their emergency beacon that gets, you know, or right. whatever. That kind of thing.
Right. So, I mean, obviously the things to talk about are the similarities, which we've kind of gone over. Other thing I noticed, and this has not really been talked about a whole lot, but, you know, Ridley Scott is really known for sort of his use of strong female leads. And I noticed something in looking at the IMDb page for this, the Charlize Theron and Noomi Rapace, who we just saw in Sherlock Holmes. She was the Madame. I can't say her name because it's French and hard to say.
The Gypsy.
Yes. And she was the original girl with the dragon tattoo person.
That's right. The original.
I noticed that Charlize and Noomi's characters are the only two female characters listed that have both a first and last name. Everyone else, all the male characters, only have either one name or there's a captain so and so. But nobody else has a full name on the cast list, which I find interesting. Not that that means anything, but it just seems like it's singling those two out somehow. You know, like they're going to be the two sort of... Obviously, I think that, you know, Noomi's character is going to be pretty strong in this. And, you know, the other person they considered for Charlize Theron's role was Angelina Jolie, who we all know can play a very strong female character. You know, I don't know if these are going to fit into a Ripley archetype or not. But,
yeah.
I just found that sort of interesting. But I am like super, 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 super excited to see this movie. You know,
I love the Alien movies. So, I mean, even though the last one got real wacky.
Yeah, I love the first three. I don't love the third one as much as I love the first two.
The first two were amazing.
The first one scared the crap out of me.
Yeah.
I refused to watch that movie for quite a bit.
The second one was done by James Cameron.
Yeah. So the second one was, I mean, it was a very much change in genre between one and two. One is very much a you know, horror flick.
Survivor.
Yeah. And two is very much an action sort of survival flick. But both done extremely well.
Get off of her, you bitch.
Yeah, it's going to be really interesting. I'm really interested to see, you know, because to me this is a return to form for Ridley because, you know, he sort of came on the scene with 1979 with Alien and then Blade Runner. So two very strong, very well-known science fiction films, and this is sort of his first real return to sci-fi. So that has got me excited. I'm really interested to see, like, a lot of the studio included hated the fact that, like, the first 45 minutes of Alien, really nothing happens. It's a very slow, slow opening. I'm wondering if he's going to keep that sort of feel for this one Because we obviously see action happening, and you see action happening in the Alien trailer, but it doesn't happen till a good way through the film. So it'll be interesting. What about you guys?
Agreed.
I'm definitely looking forward to it.
Yeah.
Just if nothing else, just because I've really enjoyed these. I'm just hoping that it's a solid movie. And the thing about it is, I don't doubt it's going to be solid, simply because of the fact that we have the original director.
Yes.
Doing this movie, it's not some. You know, it's not McG.
Right.
Not some. You know, it's not, as much as I love him, it's not Joss Whedon trying to do it in his own way. This is Ridley doing it right.
Right.
And it's very clear just from watching the trailer and just from seeing production pictures that he is working his ass off to make it as consistent and continuous from the first movie, to Alien.
Right, to get that feel.
Yeah, to get that, you know, the universe and all that stuff similar. It's not just I'm going to make it my own movie and try to one up Ridley. You know, it's Ridley doing it right. So this is how you do a reboot or you do a prequel. Use the guy.
And he's using the more, you know, current technologies too. Like the thrusters look amazing on the ship, and there was that whole laser thing, and the screens look, you know, modern day technology versus what they had back then, which is those CRTs and everything.
Funny enough, this movie should be happening in that movie's past. So,
right?
Yeah, exactly. But it's one of those things where it's like, well, we know the reason why it looked that way in the previous movie was because they didn't have the type of technology that we have now. So we just kind of forgive it, just let it slide. You know, it's one of those kind of suspension of disbelief sort of things.
I'm okay
it's,
with that.
You know, if they did then make Alien like next year as kind of the sequel to Prometheus instead of Prometheus being a prequel to Alien, it would have the current technology, blah, blah, blah. Anyways, so my thing about this trailer is I need more. This was just a teaser. I couldn't get off the fact that he was milking Alien for all it's worth, completely implied through the appearance of the title and the flash of the guy holding his helmet and looking like a screaming with the scream sound from the soundtrack playing. And it was, even though it was only for a split second, applause to him to get people excited, reminding them of Alien. But I'm not quite buying it yet. Poo-poo on the teaser, but hell yeah, I'm going to see the movie. But not because of this teaser.
There's really no subtle way for me to say this, but I have a raging sci-fi boner for this movie. So June cannot get here fast enough.
Yeah, definitely epic looking. It definitely has clearly has a lot of similarities to Alien, which is an amazing film. So I'm seeing it as a must-see. Absolutely.
Yeah, that whole Alien direct connection that he's doing with this, it's ruining it for me, because he said this is completely different story, same universe, but it's completely a separate thing. I'm like, well, then don't get too attached. Come on.
I think you'll be surprised.
Unless he lied flat out and being like,
I think we're going to see a very different movie than Alien.
I will be.
But I think we're going to see some similarities that are going to set the tone for Alien.
Yeah, I think we'd be completely surprised if at any time in this film we actually do see
an alien.
Something to do with an alien. And I'm not just saying like the homage to like the egg chamber. I'm saying like straight up seeing an egg, seeing a facehugger, seeing a. I would be surprised if we actually do see something.
I'm sure we're not going to actually see an alien.
Oh, I know we're not going to see an alien, but I'm just saying, like, there won't be any drawings on a wall or, you know what I'm saying? Like, I don't think we're really going to.
Unless they draw them on the wall.
Right.
Yeah. We'll see. We'll see what happens. Mm-hmm. But yes, we will. This will be on our list if it's not already.
So. I think it already is, actually.
No, I don't think we put anything in July or June yet. We've only got past movies in there. So, okay. Fill in the present. 6 8s or whatever is before that. Just put it in. I don't care whose week it is. Coming to your attractions for next week, because, well, that's the end of the show. next week, we're going to be taking a look at Kevin Smith's Red State. The present, we're going to be taking a look at The Devil Inside and the future of The Woman in Black. Basically, yes, Steve picked the movies.
Yay! It's horror week in January.
Woohoo!
It's like Christmas in July.
So, there's plenty of ways to contact us. Let us know what you thought about these films. Am I wrong? Was the Prometheus trailer absolutely amazing? Especially because it has all the alien stuff in it. I hate the trailer. I really do. I really dislike that trailer. Anyways, go to our website, COLmovies.com. Leave them the comments on the blog. You can also email us at colmovies@gmail.com. Leave us a voicemail. We'd like to hear from you. We'll play it on the show at 361-COL-TALK. That's 361-265-8255. Follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/COLmovies, which is essentially pulling everything from Facebook at facebook.com/COLmovies. Please pop over to iTunes. Leave us a 5-star review. We very much appreciate it. With that, any final thoughts? During the show.
I'm still recovering from 2011, so no.
Yeah, the only thing I was going to say is that for the future, we were actually going to be looking at the trailer for The Innkeepers because it's coming out in February. Mm-hmm. But it's also been out on pay-per-view. Mm. So I actually have a copy. So I'm going to be watching the Innkeepers and seeing what that's all about. But it was another one that, because it's already out, some people have seen it, that kind of thing. So I figured we would go with The Woman in Black instead, which is a Daniel Radcliffe post Harry Potter movie.
Yep.
So we're going to look at that instead.
Yep. Sweet.
How many times do we say butter during the show?
My os.
Anyways. For me. For Fuzz. For Steven. Good night, everybody.
Hasta la vista, baby.
I wish I knew how to quit you.
That'll do, kid.
That's the worst of my ever heard. I just stole it from a movie.
He's looking at you, kid.
End of line.